Welcome to the Tactical Security Podcast.
Welcome to Tactical Security, where we argue cybersecurity practices from a technical and a managerial standpoint. Here's what you need to know about today's security tactics.
This is episode 5. Made it to 5. We're about halfway there, Wolf.
How about that?
I know. Exciting stuff. So during this episode, we will continue discussing the human attack surface.
I'm Wolf, and by day I'm an advisory CISO.
I'm Dave. I work in cybersecurity professionally, but you may know my work with Hack for Kids.
And we have our guest today, Chris Roberts. Hey, Chris, welcome to Tactical Security.
Hey, guys. How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thanks for being here, man. I know we all have like a bit of a history together, so it's awesome that you're joining us on Tactical Security today.
Yeah, no, appreciate it. Thank you. It's kind of fun. Looking forward to it.
Same. So I don't know if you want to take a minute to introduce yourself to the listeners. Some of the folks here are not in our industry, so they may not know who you are, but they may know of some things you have done.
Yeah. Some of the Google infamy might follow me around a little bit. So creeping around the industry for an extended period of time, gray hair when it's not colored, currently running around with the folks at Hillbilly Hit Squad. And same as Wolf, doing some virtual CISO consulting work, research, and a whole bunch of other things, and probably fairly well known for hacking all things with wings, wheels, tracks, tires, and other things.
And cows. I will say I was dating my now wife, and I took her to one of your talks where you're talking about hacking some of the cows tracking services. Gosh, and for the next couple of days, she'd look at me and go, but seriously, are the cows okay? Did he put them back?
Oh my gosh, that was so much fun. I think that's what I love about not just our industry, but so many of the people in the industry. You know, we have some amazing folks in the industry that the way we approach, the way we think about things, the way we look at things, and then, you know, hopefully in many cases, how we try to communicate and effectively, you know, affect change, for want of a better way of putting it.
Well, one of my favorite memories of you, and there's a lot, but one of my favorite memories is when we were at CypherCon and we were in that like lounge and you're like, anybody want free wine? And you're like, what? Oh yeah, I got into the wine dispenser and it had a default password and I put it in diagnostic mode. What do you want to drink? And I was like, holy
crap. Oh my gosh. I think it's the last time I ever got invited back to that hotel. It was really-
Wonder why.
Yeah, tell me about it. I think it's, you know, it joins the long list of countries and locations and facilities and companies that I'm not allowed into anymore. It's the list keeps growing. It's quite fun sometimes.
Well, that kind of gives the listeners an idea of who you are and what you've done and what you're capable of doing. And who knows what you're going to do next? I don't even think you know. But today we're going to continue talking about the human attack surface. And one of the things that we've been asking all the guests is their definition. And I just want to also preface it with, there really is no right or wrong answer. We want to hear what Chris Roberts believes is the human attack surface.
Yeah, that one's a fun one. And I think it'll probably allude to some of the stuff I'm working on at the moment. So, I mean, traditionally, when we've always thought about the human attack surface, we've had elements from, you know, human and social engineering, the ability to influence somebody into doing something that you want them to do that might not necessarily be what they want to do. So that's always been the somewhat the traditional area. Then when we've looked at the human attack surface, to me, it's been that interface between the human and technology. And that can be everything from the regular computer to the phones they have, to the devices, the technology in their homes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's being able to maybe govern and influence their ability to use that technology or us to abuse the use of that technology. Now, some of the stuff that we're working on successfully, which is both good and scary, is the human attack surface now is invasive to the very human themselves. So for a couple of years, I've alluded to some of the stuff I've done on biotechnology, nanotechnology, and neuroscience work. And we're at a point now where we're influencing humans through directly interfacing with their biology, with the brain cycles, and actually within the cellular systems themselves. So it's both fascinating and also frightening as all heck, because as a society, you know, we as humans still have problems trying to remember passwords, let alone anything more complex than 123456. Yet on the other end of the scale, we're at a point where we can manipulate cellular systems of a human using technology. So I'm probably a little unique in that ability to get everything from the human engineering to basically attacking cells that I want to from a human attack surface standpoint. So it's kind of fun. So that's my definition.
I like how you immediately go to the logical conclusion, which is now that technology is pervasive, now that we're putting more technology on our bodies, in our bodies, that's going to open up all sorts of new threat vectors, all sorts of new ways of attacking. And that's really the future horizon, right? But before we get too far into that future, today, what's your opinion of today's top challenges, right? What is the most challenging problem when it comes to the people technology interface that you're describing?
I think the biggest challenge is truth. Is sorting out what is truth, what is reality. Maybe reality and truth go hand in hand in this one. You know, and I go back to a couple of things. First and foremost is a very, very good friend, Ryan Cloutier, kind of sums it up, which is we are still analog humans in a digital world. And when we think about communications between humans, up till recently, if I wanted to try to do something to you, I literally had to be in front of you and physically or socially engineer you. But because of the advances in technology, my ability to influence what you read, what you see, how you see it over a very short period of time, or even an extended period of time, I can now basically manipulate what you see as truth. And so when we look at humans and when we look at what we're doing, I think one of the biggest problems is how do we, what is truth? What is reality? What is, when we look at data, how can I tell if that data that is being presented to me is the source data, is reality, is the truth of the data? What can I do as a human? And what do I need to, and what should I do to actually understand what it is that I'm looking at? And whether I should believe it or not.
You know, it's interesting how you bring that up. We just, in the last episode, we managed to have a really quick kind of almost cameo. We were interviewing Ms. Bat, but she now works Chris Krebs, and he came on and he talked about disinformation very, very similarly to how you described it. But if you could, I mean, because what you just described is disinformation, but could yes. you maybe elaborate on that a little bit more, please?
Yeah, I think so. So a perfect example on this one is we won't even get into governmental disinformation. Let's just talk about information. So what is the source of information? If I turn around to you and on the internet, I tell you that the sky is bright pink, you at least have the ability potentially to look out of the window and go, nah, I really don't think it is bright pink, unless it's a sunset, at which point, yeah, maybe I have something there. But you've got the ability to sometimes verify and validate what is truth. Now, if we talk about my ability to influence you, we talk about, I mean, we have so many topical things that we could go through, be it geopolitical, geospatial, religious, vaccine related, political related. The problem and the challenge is years gone by, in order for me to influence it, it was newspapers or it was leaflets or pamphlets. That took time. The ability to me to mount a campaign took days, weeks, months, or years. But because so many of us are connected, because so many of us rely upon the various sources on the internet, and unfortunately, maybe only one or two sources on the internet, I can now sway and influence you in a matter of seconds. I can then continue to plant those pieces of information across numerous different surfaces. Again, years gone by, I had newspaper, I had word of mouth, I had the town crier, I had the street corner. I maybe had three or four different ways of reaching you. Now I have so many different ways to reach you, directly, indirectly, subtly, you know, all of these different methods can be employed very, very effectively through basically a digital interface that we are pretty much so plugged into 24/7.
Yeah. And I oftentimes wonder that, right? Because it's difficult to have the perspective. I think of the printing press, 1450. I think of the telegraph, so let's say 1850. I think of early days of television, so like say 1950. Mm-hmm. In each one of those cases, the populace at the time was completely unprepared for disinformation, right? The printing press caused all sorts of religious upheaval and, yes, and national upheaval. The telegraph, similar. There's been an argument that the pushback to the Vietnam War in like 1970s and 60s was due in large part to the television coverage.
Yep.
Is this a repeat of, look, we've got a new technology today, it's social media, and therefore people are unprepared? Or is this an entirely new scale that we're just not ready for?
I'd argue it's a new scale. I mean, it is a ridiculously extensive scale. And it's far reaching. You know, perfect example, go back to the printing press is probably, let's start with that one. The printing press was you still had to move that manually. You only were able to do a certain amount of things. You were only able, really had a single medium to go through. Telegram expanded a bit. Television definitely gave us more, no two ways about it. But again, even from a television standpoint, I think there were more ethics and morals involved, maybe, shall we say, and there was a little bit more control. Now, you can argue who had the control back then, but there was more control. So the television was in the hands of the media companies only, primarily. Yes, you had the PBS and the evening stuff, but that was it. Whereas information, disinformation, and everything else is now in the hands of, you know, out of what, 7.5 billion people, we've got what's 5.5-6 billion people connected. Every single one of those, almost without question, has the ability to influence your decision.
And one of the things that is pretty ubiquitous to all of those mediums is distribution. You know, looking at the printing press, right? You might have limited resources, but you could print one copy and people just pass it around. And you know the information is going to maintain its integrity. It's just, at what point does it stop passing around? And what point does it become irrelevant? And I'm not going to go through every example, but now with like the internet, the distribution is huge. You get a sense of, you know, the impact you're making because people click the little like button, and it's usually about 1%, or depending upon who you are, maybe 10% of your followers. So that gives you a really good idea of your impact. Now, from that standpoint, when you're kind of looking into the future, Chris, do you see this as something that's going to continue to snowball and get worse? Or you think eventually society is going to stand up and say, we've had enough. We got it. We can't do this. Keep going this direction. It's going to be self-destructive.
Let me go back to that first point, because both you and Wolf basically had a really good point. The other thing on this one to me is probably barrier to entry. So if we go back to the press, the barrier to entry was the cost and distribution. To the telegram, it was the cost. To the television, you know, if you wanted to do PBS or nighttime special, you had to pay. You had a barrier to entry. Whereas on the internet, and with all the proliferation of devices, the barrier to entry has been reduced to almost a negligible cost, let's face it.
Good point. Very, very good point.
Yeah, for anybody to put anything in there. And now with saying that, I totally screwed up. Dave, I apologize. Where the hell were we going with this?
Whether or not people are going to stand up and say we've had enough, or we're going to just continue letting the snowball until we self-destruct.
Ooh, I don't see people changing that much. I see some people maybe changing, illuminating and enlightening themselves a little more effectively. You know, perfect example, it's not perfect, but my homepage is the BBC. You know, it's not the best out there, but it's one of the best out there for a slightly more middle of the road global view as to what's happening in the world. If my homepage was, you know, the Yahoos of this world, or the CNNs, or the Foxes, or the NBCs, I don't care which side you pick, I feel like, and I have seen, you tend to get one bias or the other. Whereas with the BBC, you tend to get a more, you know, it's that civilized news channel kind of thing. But that's a very personal choice. I also will go out there and try to validate something. If I see something I don't want to trust, I want to go validate it and then maybe think about trusting it. But again, that's because we work in a world and not everybody does. You know, Snopes is one of those fun places to go check when somebody stands up and says, underneath Denver, the lizard people are bringing the Illuminati back into power. I'm like, you know, I like that. I love the idea and I love the concept. And Denver Airport, let's face it, plays on that very effectively. But I'm not too sure that we're quite there yet. So I think, unfortunately, I don't have a huge amount of faith in humanity. I'm one of those people that has unfortunately seen the worst of humanity in both the physical and the digital world, and I really don't have much faith in them. So I don't see this changing anytime soon.
Appreciate your realistic point of view. We'd expect nothing else.
The bluntness that comes with me, yes.
Bobby, love you, man. So maybe moving on to some other questions. Wolf, do you have another one for him?
Well, I was wanting to hear more about the Denver Airport and the New World Order.
Oh,
but I think
that's probably a different no, podcast. It's amazing. No, oh my gosh, it's fantastic. If you, I mean, seriously, you want to dig down rabbit holes. This one's, I mean, apparently Denver Airport's actually connected to the Cyber Mountain, to the mountain that's down in the springs. Mm-hmm. We apparently have a couple of underground tunnels going up to Montana. And yeah, underneath it, because apparently there was rather a lot of concrete used, more so than everybody thought that was viable or positive. So yeah, there's lizard people, there's an underground location for a secondary government, all sorts of things under there. I mean, it's fantastic.
I'll have to keep an eye out next time I fly into Denver.
Well, I mean, what's interesting, and I love Denver. I mean, number one, we have the hell horse as our bloody symbol outside the airport. Anybody who paints a blue horse, pucks it on the tarmac outside and puts red glowing eyes in it, I mean, talk about asking for trouble, for crying out loud. And then you look at all the symbology that's inside the airport. There's some amazing stuff in there. I mean, it's very, very provocative and very, very thought-provoking. And I love it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the center of the Illuminati is buried underneath it. I'm pretty sure they're still, you know, they're off planet on the moon base or whatever the hell somebody else. What was that Israeli general telling us, that we've got a base on the moon or on Mars or somewhere? Bless his cotton socks.
I don't know that I followed that one either. But what strikes me as interesting is the development of cognitive skills to combat disinformation, to combat conspiracies. I've got a couple different podcasts I follow that are very skeptical and kind of like a skeptical way of reasoning through the world. To counterbalance the pessimism, just to be a little bit optimistic, yeah. I hold out some hope that with education and, you know, with the proliferation of information, culture change, that maybe we can combat these things. But I say that at the same time, realizing that if you and I talked in the 90s, information is going to be free. We're going to have an open internet. Everyone's going to have access to information. That's going to usher in a new utopia.
Yeah.
And look what we built with it.
We're going to go paperless.
We built Meta and Facebook. I mean, let's face it. We basically shot ourselves in the feet with both barrels and for good measures went back and reloaded.
Yeah.
What a visual.
Yeah. But I mean, that's what we did. Let's face it. And I mean, again, so... Yeah, you know, it's an interesting way of looking at it. I think, okay, if we want to talk about hope, if we want some level of hope, here's what I want to do. And I hate to say this, but I think we need to cull everybody, not just our age and older, but I think we need to go down another level. So if you be of 30-ish years and older, please line up for the doff to the side of the head.
For the carousel.
Yeah, pretty much. That's it.
Focus around carousel.
Yeah, that's it. Because I mean, I think I look at the, and I had a fantastic conversation with a young lady yesterday on a podcast. And she's of this next generation, Z or whatever the hell they're calling it, basically the young ones. And it was really interesting because they are starting to question. They are starting to take more notice of the information that is used and abused. And they are starting to push back. And I think, and I hope that that's a trend that continues, because I don't think our generation didn't figure it out until it was too late. And let's face it, we built the monster, for crying out loud. The next generation just, I think, didn't have a freaking clue what to do with it, which is why we see so much wringing of hands. But I think the latest generation, like I look at my daughter, she's 18, and she has very set views on information and what is good and what is bad and how it should be used or how it should not be abused. So I have hope that if we cull basically everybody of our age and probably a few bits down and up above, we might actually stand a chance to do this, which kind of feeds back into this: with every new technology comes an adjustment period.
It takes a couple of generations for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, before we run out of time, I want to circle back to something you said earlier, because, all right, this new generation is equipped with even more technology. We're also putting in more technology.
Yes.
The biohacking, the biology interception. Can you give us a little more insight as to what that will look like? All right. We covered messing with people's cognition. What about messing with people's biology? And what does that look like now and into the future?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So DNA hacking is one that we're pretty heavily working on for a variety of reasons, both tactical and, you know, more humane related. But the simple fact is, you know, if we look at, you know, perfect example, I'm going through some stuff at the moment that cancer related with some folks. And at the moment, the best we can do is put them in a machine and basically bomb the hell out of almost every single part of them. Or best we can do is focus on the machine and hope for the best. If I can build a tactical device at a molecular level that can identify through chemical analysis and various other things the exact cell that needs to be smacked upside the head and target that effectively, then to me, that's fantastic. And this is the same thing for Alzheimer's and the same thing for all sorts of different things. If I have the ability to directly target a cell and basically kill it or cure it and repair it, to me, that's fantastic. And to me, that is an amazing advancement. Now, flip side is because it's encoded, we also demonstrated to the poor people that were developing this that I can recode the stupid thing to go basically attack the red blood cells, which for any of you that know biology is not a good thing to lose them.
Well, there's also, yes, completely agree with all that. But some of the other things that some folks have done as far as DNA research is these different types of genealogical type services, right? You know,
yeah.
You spit in a jar and they could tell you where you're from. But some people have this belief that is a human attack surface because somebody is collecting this DNA information and they're trying to do some kind of predictive analysis based on your DNA, your behaviors, your buying patterns.
Yes.
You know, where you're going to want to live and how much money you're going to make. And kind of like, you know, I kind of see that as one of the bigger challenges is these things are happening and there's just absolutely no visibility into it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I 100% with you on that one. That is, and that's unfortunately being, you know, it seems to be one of those human nature things that we do. Every single time we come up with a new cool thing to do, we tend to find ways to use it and abuse it against the rest of the population. It does concern me that DNA is potentially a resource and a source of data and information that can be used to profile. I know two ways about it. It scares the crap out of me. But the flip side is, unfortunately, when it comes down to DNA, it really is that next storage medium, tactical medium, identity medium, information medium, and all those other things that we have going on, because we've lost the ability to validate who we are almost any other way.
I don't know, Wolf, you got any thoughts on that? Or should we just kind of, I think we got like 5 minutes left. Should we just kind of get into that last question? Because this is a deep conversation that we don't have
all the time
for. Yeah. Gives me chills, literally. I got chills.
You and I both.
So, okay, Chris, so here's the last question for the listeners here. What would be one tactic that you would want to give the listeners to walk away from in regards to the human attack surface in cybersecurity that they can kind of use as like an action item and or make it actionable to protect themselves or just maybe not become a part of the sheeple who just give up their information?
I think it's, ironically enough, I got tagged in a post earlier on today by a really good guy, David Meese, who's doing some kind of cool stuff in the industry as well. And he was talking, it's very similar about, not just what do you do when you get into this industry, but how do you be successful? And to some degree, this is also the same thing I would advocate for any human, which is ask more questions and challenge more assumptions. And it really isn't, to me, I don't want to make it any more complicated than that. When somebody comes up to you and says, this does this, ask them how, ask them why. It's challenged. Go, well, why does it do that? What's the logic? What's the reason? And I think that goes through the whole of security. It doesn't matter if I'm trying to social engineer you by telling you, your great lost uncle has unfortunately, popped his clogs and has left you $10 billion in a Nigerian bank account. You got to kind of ask that. You should be asking those questions in the same way that when the director of the FBI, digitally knocks on your door and says, you're part of a secret group now, please send me 20 gift cards, that you probably want to ask why, and to me, those are the big things. And I think we need to ask more questions and we do need to challenge more assumptions. When somebody says, hey, this is how it is, you got to ask them why or how or what's the logic or why can't we change it? I would love more of that.
Yeah, I really like that approach from a parent as we talk with our kids, teaching them skepticism, teaching them questioning, question authority, question information.
That's a perfect way of looking at it. Wolf, I think you hit the nail on the head. That was one of those things I remember teaching my daughter because, again, because of what I do, occasionally I get knocks on the door. And the first thing I ever want to do when somebody knocks on the door is, hello, I'm from so-and-so, prove it. And when you prove it to me, just giving me an ID doesn't do it. I want to know who I can call and I'll go look up the damn number. And if you are from the bureau or from the agency or you're here to help me, great, we'll figure it out. But until I've validated who you are, do not expect trust.
Mm-hmm. Here, here. I like that a lot.
You're going to love the closing of the podcast.
Well, I think we've had a great conversation. I know we're coming up on time. So to the listener, this has been Tactical Security with Dave and Wolf. Please join us for future episodes where we will continue to dig into tactical tools and practices. And again, according to this entire season, looking at the human attack service. And Chris, thank you so much for your insights and your time today.
Oh, gentlemen, thank you very, very much for having me on. It's been an absolute honor and a pleasure.
Thank you. It was great having you. And stay healthy, everyone. Question truth and be better.